is really an honor for me to contribute with a small part to this celebration of this great country with a Spanish accent. My friends, my fellow Americans, and my brothers and sisters, it is my privilege today to introduce to you a prominent son of pioneer stock and a true friend of freedom-loving people, Elder M. Russell Ballard. As a young man, he attended the University of Utah, then pursued interest in the areas of automotive, real estate development, and financial investments. He married in 1951, he married Barbara Bowen, of whom he speaks of his wife lovingly as a great lady who has been totally and completely supportive through all these years. They have 5 daughters, 2 sons, and 33 grandchildren. Elder Ballard is a true patriot and believes it is an obligation of each citizen to honor and obey the law of the land, and that all political leaders are accountable to God for their governmental administrations. His record of civil involvement stems from a Christian commitment to his country and community. His service includes the following: the board of directors of the Freedom Foundation at Valley Forge in the 1980s, the board of directors of the Chamber of Commerce in 1980s, the Salt Palace Advisory Committee, Salt Lake County Transportation Implementation Task Force, Utah Statehood Centennial Commission, which a celebration is scheduled for 1996, the Downtown Alliance of Salt Lake City. He is also the chairman of the LDS Pioneer Sesquicentennial Committee, with a celebration scheduled for 1997. He believes in freedom to worship God according to the dictates of one's own conscience, as did the pilgrim forefathers who came to this joyous land seeking religious freedom. In pursuing that freedom of worship, Elder Ballard served two-year mission to England, served as a bishop twice, and has been on 2 high councils. In 1974, he was called to preside over the Canada-Toronto mission, and in 1976 was called to the first quorum of the 70. 4 years later, he became a member of the presidency of that quorum, and then, in 1985, he was called to be a member of the Council of the 12. Elder Ballard is a loyal American, a diplomat, and a friend. In all of his assignments, civic and ecclesiastical, he has brought credit and honor to this country and to his church. Because of some of my responsibilities in the church, I have had the privilege of accompanying Elder Ballard upon occasion to various Latin American countries, where in times of uncertainty and under difficult circumstances, I have caused to appreciate and reaffirm his ability as a master of wise counsel and leadership. In all cases, especially in countries where the image of the United States could be distorted, Elder Ballard has been an outstanding representative of valor for this great country. His character and integrity are above reproach. It's an honor for me to present to you my friend, Elder M. Russell Ballard.
This has been a wonderful program. I think we ought to give Laura Lee a Freedom Foundation Award for courage. I don't know whether you've got one for that or not. But to Paul Larson and Terry Hill and the orchestra and the chorus, thank you so very much for the beautiful music and all that you've contributed this evening. And Stanford, if I get in trouble up here, I'll just feel free to call on you to bail me out. You did wonderfully well. 216 years ago, the Continental Congress adopted the Declaration of Independence. Of that event, John Adams said, "I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of the continent to the other, from this time forward, forevermore. This Provo Utah Freedoms Festival surely fits John Adams' vision of our day." At the outset, please know that I do not represent myself to be an expert on religion in a free society, the subject of my talk tonight. I gratefully acknowledge the thoughtful suggestions of those who are knowledgeable and who have willingly shared with me their thoughts, some of which I've included in what I will say. I do, however, believe that I have some expertise as a father of our 7 married children who have given to my wife and me the experience of being grandparents to their 33 children. It is because of my love for them and my deep concern that they and others like them be able to enjoy all the privileges of religious liberty that I express my thoughts this evening. The breeze of freedom is blowing today with greater velocity throughout the world than perhaps any other time in history. However, a gathering like this would still not be legally permissible in many places. We're meeting here on the Brigham Young University campus, where the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints freely supports this great institution. Recently, a group of religious and political leaders and scholars from all around the world met in Budapest, Hungary, to discuss the practical challenges faced by the former communist nations that are moving toward some form of religious liberty. The concept of religious freedom is revolutionary for many countries, and they are struggling with many potentially divisive issues. To what extent should public schools recognize and teach religion? How much should the state regulate the church's charitable activities? Should churches be exempted from general laws? To what degree should church and state be separated? Should there be an official state church? Do those issues sound familiar? They should. Our founding fathers wrestled with them more than 200 years ago, and they continue to be serious topics of discussion and debate to this very day. The latitude we have for disagreement and discourse more than 200 years after the United States Constitution and its Bill of Rights were enacted is a remarkable testimony to the enduring nature of those precious documents. The principles and philosophies upon which our constitutional law is based are not simply the results of the best efforts of a remarkable group of brilliant men. They were inspired by God, and the rights and privileges guaranteed in the Constitution are God-given, not man-derived. The freedom and independence afforded by the Constitution and Bill of Rights are divine rights, sacred, essential, and inalienable. In the 98th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, the Lord indicates that the law of the land, which is constitutional, supporting that principle of freedom in maintaining rights and privileges, belongs to all mankind and is justifiable before me. I focus my comments this evening on 16 significant words found in the very First Amendment to the Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. These words are simple and direct. Their message and meaning appear to be crystal clear. But through the years, presidents, Congress, and the courts have interpreted them in so many different ways that many people today have no sense of the perspective upon which they were based originally. Believe it or not, at one time the very notion of government had less to do with politics than with virtue. According to James Madison, often referred to as the father of the Constitution, we have staked the whole future of American civilization upon the power of the government. Far from it, we have staked the future of all of our political institutions upon the capacity of each and all of us to govern ourselves according to the Ten Commandments of God. Close quote. George Washington George Washington agreed with his colleague James Madison. Said Washington, "Reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle." Close quote. Nearly 100 years later, Abraham Lincoln responded to a question about which side God was on during the Civil War with this profound thought: "I'm not at all concerned about that, for I know that the Lord is always on the side of right. But it is my constant anxiety and prayer that I and this nation should be on the Lord's side." Close quote. Madison, Washington, and Lincoln all understood that democracy cannot possibly flourish in a moral vacuum, and that organized religion plays an important role in preserving and maintaining public morality. Indeed, John Adams, another of America's founding fathers, insisted, "We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions, unbridled by morality and religion." Close quote. Yet that is precisely the position we find ourselves in today. Our government is succumbing to the pressure to distance itself from God and religion. Consequently, the government is discovering that it is incapable of contending with people who are increasingly unbridled by morality and religion. A simple constitutional prohibition of a state-sponsored church has evolved into court-ordered bans against, one, representations of the Ten Commandments on government buildings, two, Christmas manger scenes on public property, and now recently, three, public prayer in public meetings. Instead of seeking the national morality based on religious principle that Washington spoke of, many are actively seeking a blind standard of legislative amorality, with a total exclusion of the mention of God in the public square. Such a standard of religious exclusion is absolutely and unequivocally counter to the intention of those who designed our government. Do you think that a mere chance placed the freedom to worship according to individual conscience among the first freedoms specified in the Bill of Rights, freedoms that are destined to flourish together or perish separately? The founding fathers understood this country's spiritual heritage. They frequently declared that God's hand was upon this nation and that he was working through them to create what Chesterton once wrote, a nation with the soul of a church. While they were influenced by history in their accumulated knowledge and learning, the simple, most influential reference source for their work on the Constitution was the Holy Bible. Doubtless they were familiar with the Lord's counsel to the children of Israel as they struggled to become a great nation. Quote, "And it shall come to pass, if thou shalt hearken diligently unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe and do all his commandments which I command thee this day, that the Lord thy God will set thee on high above all nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come on thee and overtake thee, if thou shalt hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God. Blessed shalt thou be in the city, and blessed shalt thou be in the field. Blessed shall be the fruit of thy body, and the fruit of thy ground, and the fruit of thy cattle, the increase of thine kine, and the flocks of thy sheep. Blessed shall be thy basket and thy store. Blessed shall be thou be when thou comest in, and blessed thou shalt be when thou goest out. The Lord shall cause thine enemies to rise up against thee, to be smitten before thy face. They shall come out against thee one way, and flee before thee seven ways. The Lord shall command the blessings upon thee in thy storehouses, and in all that thou settest thine hand unto. And he shall bless thee in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. The Lord shall establish thee an holy people unto himself, as he hath sworn unto thee, if thou shalt keep the commandments of the Lord thy God and walk in his ways." Close quote. In other words, that nation that keeps God's commandments and walks in his ways will prosper. The framers of the Constitution knew that, and they tried to lay a solid moral foundation for a society that could be so blessed. As they did so, perhaps they thought of Roger Williams and others like him who made an heroic fight for religious freedom. Roger Williams, as you know, was one of the most courageous leaders of the Puritan movement. He began his ministry in England, where his zealous work to free the church from the influence of the king brought the wrath of the government upon him. Eventually, he and his young wife were forced to flee to the New World. But instead of finding himself among like-minded reformers in America, he encountered much of the same resistance and persecution until he established a new colony called Providence in Rhode Island. Here America had its first taste of true religious freedom. And the success of the Providence colony convinced many that the concept tasted good. The founding fathers very likely were aware of the experiences of Roger Williams and others when they wrote the First Amendment, that the government cannot impede the free exercise of religion. They wrote that the church and the state were to be separate, independent entities, not to eliminate morality in God's laws, but to make sure that the power of government could never be used to silence religious expression or to persecute religious practice. Once again, quoting George Washington, "If I could have entertained the slightest apprehension that the Constitution framed in the convention, where I had the honor to preside, might possibly endanger the religious rights of any ecclesiastical society, certainly I would never have placed my signature to it." What would Washington have thought if he could have foreseen our day? Would he have signed the document? I believe he would have been troubled to see a time when citizens are forbidden to pray in public meetings, when people claim that you can't legislate morality, as if any law ever passed did not have at its heart some notion of right and wrong, when churches are called intruders, when churches are called intruders, when they speak out against public policy that is contrary to the commandments of God, when many people reject the correcting influence of churches if it infringes on daily living, when religion is accepted as a social organization but not as an integral part of the national culture, when people bristle if churches speak in any form except from the pulpit. Indeed, some people now claim that the Founding Fathers' worst fear in connection with religion has been realized, that we have, in fact, a state-sponsored religion in America today. This new religion, adopted by many, does not have an identifiable name, but it operates just like a church. It exists in the form of doctrines and beliefs where morality is whatever a person wants it to be, and where freedom is derived from the ideas of man and not the laws of God. Many people adhere to this concept of morality with religious zeal and fervor, and courts and legislators tend to support it. While you may think I'm stretching the point a bit to say that amorality could be a new state-sponsored religion, I believe you would agree that we do not have to look far to find horrifying evidence of rampant immorality that is permitted, if not encouraged, by our laws. From the plague of pornography to the devastation caused by addiction to drugs, illicit sex, and gambling, wickedness rears its ugly head everywhere, often gaining its foothold in society by invoking the powers of constitutional privilege. We see a sad reality of contemporary life when many of the same people who defend the right of a pornographer to distribute exploitative films and photos would deny freedom of expression to people of faith because of an alleged fear of what might happen from religious influence on government or public meetings. While much of the society has allowed gambling to wash over its communities, leaving broken families and individuals in its soul-destroying wake, it reserves its harshest ridicule for those who advocate obedience to God's commandments and uniform inspired standards of right and wrong. As M.J. Sobran recently wrote, "A religious conviction is now a second-class conviction, expecting to step deferentially to the back of the secular bus and not to get uppity about it," close quote. There are probably many reasons for the change in public attitudes towards religion. Certainly, we've had too many wolves posing as shepherds, promoting a natural skepticism toward any who profess to represent God on earth. Of course, the news media, which rarely report on the good things churches are doing in the world, almost never miss an opportunity to tell people when active church members do wrong. We read about crimes that are committed by the former Sunday school teachers, ministers, or missionaries. But when was the last time you read that a crime was committed by someone who hasn't stepped inside of a church in 40 years? For that matter, when was the last time you saw religion or people of faith portrayed positively in any film or television program? For the most part, Hollywood's attitude towards religion is typified by the expression of the cartoon character Bart Simpson, whose mealtime grace consisted of these words: "Dear God, we pay for all of this stuff ourselves, so thanks for nothing." Can you imagine how embarrassed and disappointed our founding fathers would be to know of the blasphemous disregard that many of those in the media have for God, our eternal Father? In fact, noted film critic Michael Medved accuses Hollywood of a deliberate attempt to undermine organized religion. According to Medved, quote, "A war against standards leads logically and inevitably to hostility to religion, because it is religious faith that provides the ultimate basis for our standards. Organized religion finds itself increasingly on the defensive. Close quote. Not only are people questioning the right of the church, any church, to be involved in matters of public policy, but some are even beginning to wonder whether the church is entitled to exert any kind of meaningful influence in people's lives. As one churchgoer recently said on a radio talk show, quote, "I think the world of my minister, as long as he doesn't try to tell me how to live my life." Close quote. Is it any wonder, then, that religion now finds itself under attack in legislative assemblies and in the courts? In fact, the United States Supreme Court recently discontinued the time-honored judicial standard that gave considerable legal latitude to the free exercise of religion, allowing people of faith to practice their religion free from the burdening effects of public policy is, according to the court, a luxury that we can no longer afford. While the justices acknowledged that the ruling would place at a relatively disadvantage those religious practices that are not widely engaged in, they said it was an unavoidable consequence of a democratic government. I do not promote the religious practice that was in question in that case, but I'm concerned with the long-term implications of the decision. Wherever religious groups are in the minority and are not considered part of the mainline religious community, the potential for state intrusion upon their religious practices is real. With legislative bodies responding most often to the will of the majority, the free exercise of religion by minority faith groups is in peril. The Religious Freedoms Restoration Act, H.R. 2797, is presently before Congress. This important piece of legislation is designed to restore the protection for religious freedom that existed before the recent Supreme Court decision placed those protections in jeopardy. Because the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is necessary for the preservation of the free exercise of religion, it demands our support. The constitutional provisions relating to government and religion were not intended to control the religious rights of people. Rather, they were intended to expand them and eliminate the fear of government intrusion. These provisions were meant to separate religion and government so that religion would be independent. The experiences of Roger Williams and other reformers provided our constitutional fathers with important facts to help them deal with the potential risk of a state religion corrupted by politics. Consequently, they drafted an article in the Bill of Rights to guarantee religious freedom from government as opposed to the government freedom from religion. In fact, the framers of the Constitution probably assumed that religious freedom would establish religion as a watchdog over government, and believed that free churches would inevitably stand and speak against immoral or corrupt legislation. To do so, all churches not only have the right to speak out on public moral issues, but they have the solemn obligation to do so. Religion represents society's conscience and must speak out when government chooses a course that is contrary to the laws of God. To remember the influence of religion from public policy, to remove that from public policy simply because some are uncomfortable with any degree of moral restraint is like a passenger on a sinking ship who removes his life jacket because it's restrictive and uncomfortable. We live in a day of political and social unrest. People are beginning to understand that more money and new government programs do not solve the problems of a disintegrating morality in the homes and communities. People in the land have a feeling that things are not right. Voters everywhere are looking for a great leader to come along and straighten everything out. The buzzwords family values are being incorporated in almost every politician's favorite 30-second soundbite. But what does that phrase really mean? Whose values are we going to embrace? The values of politicians? The values the media tell us we should cherish? The values of special interest groups and organizations? The values of rank and file Americans as determined by a scientific survey? Obviously, it would not be politically expedient to say that the values that our founding fathers drew upon are eternal, unchanging values. But that is a fact. The values that made us great in reality are the commandments of God. They provide the foundation upon which our republic was built. And if American democracy seems shaky today, it's only because that foundation has been eroded and weakened under the guise of separation of church and state. Now that I think about it, maybe Washington really was speaking of our day when he said, "If I could conceive that the general government might ever be so administered as to render the liberty of conscience insecure, no one would be more zealous than myself to establish effectual barriers against the horrors of spiritual tyranny and every species of religious persecution." Close quote. Samuel Adams, who is sometimes called the father of the American Revolution, wrote, "I thank God that I have lived to see my country independent and free. She may long enjoy her independence and freedom if she will. It depends upon her virtue." That means it depends on us. If we would maintain the independence and freedom the founding fathers intended, we must work to preserve and protect the moral foundation upon which they built our government. We must stand boldly for righteousness and truth, and must defend the cause of honor, decency, and personal freedom espoused by Washington, Madison, Adams, Lincoln, and other leaders who acknowledged and loved God. Otherwise, we will find ourselves in the same predicament, President Lincoln observed in 1863. Said Lincoln, "We have grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no nation has ever grown, but we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand which preserved us in peace and multiplied and enriched and strengthened us. We have vainly imagined, in the deceitfulness of our hearts, that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace, too proud to pray to the God that made us." Close quote. On this occasion, let us resolve to make our own families truly free by teaching them that God holds us all accountable. His laws are absolutes. Breaking them brings misery and unhappiness. Keeping them brings joy, happiness, and the blessings of heaven. Let us teach our families and others the importance of moral responsibility based on the laws of God. Let us all resolve to listen to moral voices from churches and to those who speak in moral absolutes based on the commandments of God. Let us never support legislation or legislators that sponsor laws contrary to the laws of God. The freedoms we give thanks for tonight is at stake for ourselves and for our posterity. No nation or people that rejects God or His commandments can prosper or find happiness. History and the Scriptures are filled with examples of nations that rejected God. Let us be wise and remember the source of our blessings and not be timid or apologetic in sharing this knowledge with others. There is no better place in this precious land of America than the great state of Utah for a people to embrace and declare that our trust is in God and that we will look to His commandments and teachings for values that will fortify and give direction to society and to our families. Only these values can ensure true happiness, lasting peace and joy. May the leaders of the churches of America and the churches of Utah be allowed to help our nation and state to embrace these basic principles espoused and fought for by the founding fathers of this great nation. This is my prayer for all of us, but most especially for the future of my children and grandchildren and for yours. And I offer it humbly but boldly in the name of God's own Son, even Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.